The divide over whether this technology is a tool for changing society by working within the system or by disrupting it from the outside predates the invention of Bitcoin by a few decades. It traces back to a 1987 debate between the physicist Timothy C. May and the economist and entrepreneur Phil Salen, two early internet visionaries whose difference of opinion laid the groundwork for the cypherpunk movement, a community of computer scientists, mathematicians, hackers, and avid science fiction readers whose work and writings influenced the creation of Bitcoin, WikiLeaks, Tor, BitTorrent, and more. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. And we've got a really great read from Reason.com. Reason Magazine is a great place for not necessarily libertarian, even though they're very libertarian leaning, but just very sensible writing. I have a lot of great stuff on this, and they have been killing it with a series that they've been releasing. I think part three just dropped yesterday or the day before or something. But a four-part series on cypherpunks, on the history of the cypherpunk movement, how it led to Bitcoin, and everything, like the mentality and the foundation of all of this stuff. And it's a really good series. I cannot recommend it enough. And they have been writing, they've recently written a couple of articles in line with this, about this topic, and this is one of those articles, and it is a great one. We will be getting into it in just a moment. For anybody new to Bitcoin who's looking for a great mobile wallet to start exploring, Hexa Wallet is a great option, and they are supporting the Bitcoin Audible podcast. It's really good for those particularly who might not be super familiar with the Bitcoin terminology. And something that's really cool that I think is highly undervalued is that they actually start you off with a test account. There is a parallel network to Bitcoin that's just Test BTC, and it's where you can get familiar with how transactions work, and you don't have to risk any money on it. Like, it's not of any monetary value, but it works exactly like Bitcoin does. And so you have a test account by default, and you can send and receive in that account. And there's plenty of like faucets and like other things that you can do online to start dipping your toes in the water. And I don't know of any other mobile wallet that has that. So it's a really great way to kind of dip your toes in before actually buying your first Bitcoin. So that is at hexawallet.io. They've got a lot of great features coming in the future as well. And they are in beta right now. So feedback is wonderful. For anything that you can share about your experience. And I am always open to answer any questions or help you out, or of course, become one of your contacts in your Hexa wallet. Shoot me a DM, or you can contact me at guyswan.com. I've got contact info at the bottom of the page. But let's go ahead and jump into today's read. Again, this is at reason.com, and it's by Jim Epstein, who is actually the author or the creator of the documentary series, and it's titled, How Will Bitcoin Lead to More Freedom? The 1987 debate that foreshadowed the divide in today's cryptocurrency community. Katie Hahn has one of Bitcoin's most improbable conversion stories. As an attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice, she prosecuted the two corrupt federal agents working the Silk Road case and created the federal government's first cryptocurrency task force. Quote, I'm the prosecutor who helped put some of the earliest Bitcoin criminals in jail, she boasted in a 2018 speech. But while learning about Bitcoin as a crime fighter, it dawned on her, quote, how profoundly this technology could change how we do all sorts of things. Han is now a general partner at the venture capital fund Andreessen Horowitz, or A16Z, where she co-leads its crypto funds with over $350 million raised since 2018. The firm is betting on blockchain as a new computing platform that will, among other things, create a decentralized financial system and fulfill the web's original promise as an open network controlled by its users. Blockchain computing, quote, feels like the early days of the internet, Web 2.0, or smartphones all over again, end quote, according to A16Z's crypto thesis. Han also sits on the board of the nonprofit organization overseeing Facebook's cryptocurrency project, Libra. At a 2019 congressional hearing, David Marcus, head of the company's blockchain group, assured lawmakers, quote, let me be clear and unambiguous. Facebook will not offer the Libra digital currency until we have fully addressed regulators' concerns and received appropriate approvals, end quote. In their embrace of regulation, Han and Marcus are at one extreme of the cryptocurrency community. On the other end are the so-called Bitcoin maximalists, who have a name for projects like Libra, Shitcoin. Quote, I would not be interested in Bitcoin if governments didn't want to ban it, the software developer Pierre Richard tweeted in 2017. In a December 2019 essay titled, Cryptocurrency is Most Useful for Breaking Laws and Social Constructs, Open Money Initiative founder Jill Carlson wrote that cryptocurrency wasn't designed to solve, quote, mainstream problems. It's a tool used by freedom fighters and terrorists, by journalists and dissidents, by scammers and black market dealers, by sex workers or people procuring drugs on the internet. The type of person Katie Hahn once worked to put in jail. Bitcoin maximalists like Richard believe that governments will eventually attempt to ban Bitcoin because it's destined to replace fiat money, which will, among other things, eliminate their power to print money to finance the welfare warfare state. The divide over whether this technology is a tool for changing society by working within the system or by disrupting it from the outside predates the invention of Bitcoin by a few decades. It traces back to a 1987 debate between the physicist Timothy C. May and the economist and entrepreneur Phil Salen, two early internet visionaries whose difference of opinion laid the groundwork for the cypherpunk movement, a community of computer scientists, mathematicians, hackers, and avid science fiction readers whose work and writings influenced the creation of Bitcoin, WikiLeaks, Tor, BitTorrent, and more. Reason is publishing a four-part documentary series on the cypherpunk movement. The first two installments are available here and here. The Bitcoin maximalists often use the shitcoin moniker to refer to cryptocurrency projects that are outright scams, technologically flawed, or cheap imitations of Satoshi Nakamoto's invention, when in reality, the world only needs one currency. Bitcoin, they maintain, is best understood as sound money, and Silicon Valley's infatuation with, quote, blockchain technology is, quote, a great example of cargo cult science, as the economist Saifedean Ammous wrote in the Bitcoin Standard, the decentralized alternative to central banking. But the community's divide is also partly rooted in a disagreement over whether cryptocurrency is essentially a technology of resistance that derives value from being impervious to government interference and control, or whether it's a tool for transforming society from within, in which case government regulation won't sink the entire enterprise. A careful look at the debate that started with May and Salen in the 1980s helps us understand the best arguments of both sides. Blacknet, a technological means of undermining all governments. In 1987, before the launch of the World Wide Web, May and Salen were part of a small community of West Coast science fiction-obsessed technologists mulling the implications of a decentralized, global information network running on personal computers. It was clear to May and Salen that the internet would remake the world. but they disagreed on what kind of software would serve as the linchpin. Salen saw technology as a way to gradually drive down the transaction costs that impede human activity, making it feasible to interact in ways that would otherwise be prohibitively expensive. Quote, "I'm interested in how to lower costs," Salen told Reason in 1984. The Austrian School of Economics' insight is that any industry run as a planned economy for any time should be fertile ground for an entrepreneur. In 1986, he started the American Information Exchange, or AMEX, one of the first e-commerce startups. Salen, whose intellectual hero was the Austrian economist Friedrich Hayek, envisioned AMEX as a global marketplace for the buying and selling of local expertise that would enhance human cooperation and gradually replace central planning. In a 1991 essay, Salen envisioned a, quote, "fluid, transaction-oriented market system with two-way feedback" that could result in, quote, "crowding out monolithic, mostly government bureaucracies." The same language could be applied to many projects in the modern cryptocurrency space. Facebook's Libra, for example, promises to use blockchain technology to move money around the world in a manner that's, quote, "as easy and cost-effective as sending a message or sharing a photo." The project's backers maintain that enabling frictionless payments for the 1.7 billion people around the world without access to banking will do wonders for alleviating poverty. These frictions are mostly created by government regulation. What's implicit in Facebook's pitch is that those rules will be gradually crowded out, though not overthrown. After being introduced to Salen by his friend Chip Morningstar, a computer scientist, in December of 1987, May drove out to Redwood City, California to meet Salen and hear his pitch for AMEX. He grasped the idea immediately, but it bored him. Quote, "People aren't going to sell meaningless stuff like surfboard recommendations," May recalled telling Salen. May didn't think AMEX was a scam, like many modern cryptocurrency ventures that earned that descriptor shitcoin, but he was interested in upending society and didn't see how AMEX would have much of an impact. May suggested to Salen that he reconceive of the project as an anonymous platform for selling company trade secrets, quote, "such as plans for that B-1 bomber or a process for a technology." In a thought experiment, May later called his idea Blacknet, writing a pretend advertisement for the service that it would turn, quote, "nation states, export laws, patent laws, national security considerations, and the like, into relics of the pre-cyberspace era." In a series of personal notes following his meeting with Salen, which May shared with Reason prior to his death in 2018, he mused that Blacknet was a, quote, "technological means of undermining all governments." Though some might say that, quote, "it won't be allowed to happen," that technology would probably make it inevitable, he wrote. May's ideas about Blacknet evolved over the years. In 1986, a friend had given him a photocopy of Werner Vinge's 1981 novella, True Names, in which hackers inhabit a virtual world called the Other Plane, where the government can't decipher their real identities. It had a big impact on May, who meddled the Other Plane with Galt's Gulch from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which was a safe haven for rational and productive people protected from government coercion and taxation by an invisible shield. Instead of the Colorado Mountains, May's cyberspace Galt's Gulch would exist on the internet, with cryptography providing the protective cover. Quote, "just as the technology of printing altered and reduced the power of medieval guilds and the social power structure," May wrote in his 1988 manifesto, "so too will cryptologic methods fundamentally alter the nature of corporations and of government interference in economic transactions." Bitcoin isn't Blacknet or a Galt's Gulch in cyberspace. It's a decentralized form of non-governmental money. But it's designed to be impervious to outside tampering so that the government can't destroy it or undermine its value. And it's roughly in keeping with May's vision of an unstoppable technology. Quote, "The nature of sound money lies precisely in the fact that no human is able to control it." Amos wrote in the Bitcoin Standard, "Bitcoin exists orthogonally to the law. There is virtually nothing that any government authority can do to affect or alter its operation." The American Information Exchange, exploiting the gray areas. The computer scientist E. Dean Tribble, who worked with Salen at Amix, calls May the shock jock of the cypherpunk movement. "Blacknet is not a goal," he says. "Blacknet is a negative consequence." Morningstar, the pioneering computer scientist who Salen hired to oversee the building of Amix, recalls his boss's skepticism of May's ideas about escaping, quote, "the structures and dysfunction of the mainstream governed world." The establishment has, quote, "had a long history of confronting new challenges and somehow having its way." Salen died of cancer in 1991 at age 41. His friend and colleague Mark S. Miller, a computer scientist, would flesh out the case that technology impacts society by gradually transforming it from within. Miller drew an analogy to a genetic takeover in biology, in which an alternative way of doing things slowly takes the place of an existing paradigm. Projects like Amix, which was centrally controlled by a company, didn't need to be completely incorruptible to have an impact because of all the gray areas where regulation doesn't apply. Permissionless innovation pushes society in the direction of more freedom and decentralization. For example, quote, "When people started doing credit card transactions over the internet, nobody knew if it was legal," Miller tells Reason, "but they just started doing it." Miller doesn't consider Libra to be a worthless project, despite Marcus's commitment to cooperate with regulators. "Once it starts operating," Miller says, "there could still be experimentation happening at the margins. There could also be gateways to trading between Libra and something permissionless, which would help expand the cryptocurrency space." Miller's writings have often focused on how rules baked into computer code could replace aspects of the legal system. Along with K. Eric Drexler, the father of nanotechnology, he co-authored a series of papers applying economic insights to software design, which influenced the work of the computer scientist, legal scholar, and early cypherpunk, Nick Szabo. It was Szabo who coined the term smart contracts, self-executing arrangements written in code, and a common feature in today's cryptocurrency projects. Szabo analogized his concept to a vending machine. A buyer drops in a coin, and a machine provides the candy bar. Quote, "The fundamental logic here is automating if this, then that on a self-executing basis with finality," Szabo wrote. He also offered the example of a smart contract for auto repossession. Quote, "If the owner fails to make payments, the smart contract invokes the lien protocol, which returns control of the car keys to the bank." A divide in the community over the definition of a smart contract also relates back to Salen's debate with May. Do smart contracts have to be shielded from third-party interference to be worthy of the name? What if a government regulator has the power to stick a hand into the metaphorical vending machine to stop the candy bar from dropping into the slot? Does that undermine the purpose of smart contracts? Miller and Morningstar consider Amix to be, quote, "possibly the first smart contracting system ever created," because it used software to mediate transactions between two parties. Deals on Amix combined a written component, like a traditional contract, and a self-executing component. Once a buyer and seller agreed on a price for a service, payment would be carried out by software. If there was a dispute, it would be resolved by humans. Amix software ran on a central server, meaning the company or a government regulator could theoretically interfere with the execution of a sale. According to Morningstar and Miller, the potential for interference doesn't undermine the purpose of the smart contract. Quote, "A smart contract that trusts a third party removes the killer feature of trustlessness," wrote Jimmy Song, a Bitcoin maximalist and influential figure in the space, in his 2018 essay, "The Truth About Smart Contracts." Song applies his critique to a popular crypto business model, which Miller has also written about, using smart contracts to trade physical assets, such as land. Countries like Sweden and Georgia have explored operating a land registry that uses blockchains and smart contracts. Szabo explored this idea in a 1998 paper that predated blockchains and Bitcoin, titled Secure Property Titles with Owner Authority. Physical assets are traded with smart contracts through what's called tokenization. A property is assigned a digital tag with a corresponding private key. A seller uses that key to transfer ownership to the buyer, much like a Bitcoin transaction. The record of ownership is encoded into a blockchain, which is a type of shared public database, so all parties know that it hasn't been corrupted. Quote, "There is an intractable problem in linking a digital to a physical asset, whether it be fruit, cars, or houses," Song wrote. "It suffers from the same trust problem as normal contracts because physical assets are regulated by the jurisdiction you happen to be in." So, if a judge refuses to honor that tokenized transaction, or a conqueror shows up at the door with an army, the smart contract will have accomplished nothing. Quote, "Ownership of the token cannot have dependencies outside of the smart contracting platform," wrote Song, who sees smart contracts as useful only in systems like Bitcoin, where the digital token itself holds value. Miller offered a rebuttal to this argument in a lecture titled Computer Security as the Future of Law in 1997, predating Song's article by 21 years. He laid out a vision for a gradual takeover of the existing law by smart contracts. "We live in a world where different systems of rules are layered on top of each other," he explained. "When Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky play chess, they had to abide by the rules of the board, dictating, for example, that bishops can only move diagonally. They were simultaneously governed by another set of rules because the two men were biological creatures embedded in physics. A Macintosh operating system is another example of a system that imposes a set of rules spelled out in software embedded in another set of rules, i.e. legal strictures, physics, and biology. The rules on these different layers impact each other. For example, the physical world and the legal world have distinct sets of rules. But in legal disputes, quote, physical possession has extraordinary influence in the actual outcome of the dispute, even if abstractly, the law would have it otherwise," end quote. If an object that belongs to you is in another person's house, taking them to court to get possession of that object is rarely worth the hassle. Amex integrated computer-mediated contracts and human-negotiated contracts. It's true that humans, including government regulators, could override a transaction on Amex, but for practical reasons, that was unlikely to occur very often. Therefore, smart contracts on Amex would have fulfilled their purpose in the vast majority of cases by reducing transaction costs with computer-mediated contracting. Miller elaborated on this idea in a discussion of land registries in, quote, "The Digital Path, Smart Contracts and the Third World," a 2003 paper that he co-wrote with Mark Stiegler. It acknowledges that a smart contracting system, quote, "unlike government-based title transfer, won't be backed by a coercive enforcement apparatus." But the authors proposed various add-ons to make it more likely that participants will, quote, "treat these titles as legitimate claims, including a community rating system, and video contracting, an idea first proposed by Szabo, in which a conversation is recorded testifying to the validity of the arrangement in question. These tools don't guarantee that governments will honor and enforce smart contracts, but there's also a high cost to ignoring them. Szabo summed up this idea best in his 1998 paper, "While thugs can still take physical property by force, the continued existence of correct ownership records will remain a thorn in the side of usurping claimants." Miller, Morningstar, and Tribble, who were involved with Amex in the 1980s, have come together once again to try and make good on Salen's vision. Miller and Tribble co-founded a startup called Agoric, which seeks to build a secure smart contracting system that would serve as the backbone of a more decentralized internet, luring some high-level computer scientists away from comfortable jobs at the biggest software companies in Silicon Valley. May passed away suddenly in 2018 at age 66. In the months leading up to his death, he was feeling disgusted with the proliferation of cryptocurrency conferences and regulated blockchain ventures. "I think Satoshi would barf," he told CoinDesk. "Attempts to be regulatory friendly will likely kill the main uses of cryptocurrencies, which are not just another form of PayPal or Visa." In May's view, society still faced a, quote, fork in the road, freedom versus permissioned and centralized systems. There are no gray areas. And that will conclude Reason.com article by Jim Epstein. And again, the links are available. I'll put them in the show notes as well. There's actually a lot of other stuff that is linked to in this piece. For example, Jimmy Song's The Truth About Smart Contracts. I have that in audio. That was actually ages ago. It was read 92. God, it feels like a million years ago now. But The Truth About Smart Contracts is a really good one. We've got Bit Gold by Nick Szabo, and we really dig into that for a whole show. That one was a really good one. And then the one he mentioned, also by Nick Szabo, Securing Property with Owner Authority. That is also one we have in audio. That's read 118. Bit Gold was 275. I'll talk maybe briefly about some of those, but we'll link to those in the show notes if you want to dig a little bit deeper, because those are really fascinating topics that go a lot deeper into this stuff. But obviously, if you've been listening to this show for any time here, I definitely lean towards Timothy May on this, that this is about fundamentally replacing these systems. And I think the best example actually to get into why is talking about Miller's piece, Smart Contracts and the Third World, and that analogy and what fundamentally is the problem there. But before we get into that, I want to take a quick break. I got to get something to drink, and we'll talk about our sponsor real fast. So I've talked about Liberty Classroom a lot recently on the show, and I have been pushing them because I've been a longtime customer of Tom Woods. I mean, I love his show, and he is an excellent source of everything economics and history, and Liberty Classroom is a great resource for that. So if you want to check it out, you can find it at guyswan.com/liberty. But it is definitely on the advanced side. It's somebody who wants to further their education after having gone through school. But there's another great one, the Ron Paul curriculum. This is actually a K-12 homeschool program and college prep course. And this is going to be way better and way cheaper than what you get in public schooling. This is not Common Core. It's largely self-taught. It's like 98% self-taught over grade 3. There are 8,200 video-based lessons in this. And you don't have to buy any textbooks. Like, PDFs are just on-site. They're free. You have weekly writing assignments. And best of all, the things that they don't teach you in school, how to run your own business and deal with personal finances. Where else can you get that kind of education for your kids? And in COVID days, a lot of parents are having to homeschool anyway. So what could be the cost of at least just looking into this? And it comes with a 100% money back guarantee. So you can check out the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum at guyswan.com/Ron Paul. And if you're just interested in diving into economics or history yourself, or you want to give it as a gift, you can do the Liberty Classroom at guyswan.com/liberty. These are just two great programs that I know some of you out there can benefit from, so I wanted to share it. And of course, signing up through my links will also support the podcast. So this article, a huge thank you again to Reason for putting this together, and Jim Epstein for putting all of this stuff together. with the documentary series that's going on right now. It's just really cool to actually see someone really dig into this, and I would like to see it get a lot of traction, because this is a fascinating story that tells us, you know, 20, 30 years of what led to the ultimate arrival of Bitcoin. And the crazy thing is that you can go all the way back then to, you know, to Saylin and May's argument and see the same divide that led to which path we took with Bitcoin. Like, that was the ultimate argument in 2017, you know, in, you know, kind of a roundabout sense, was which direction was the protocol going to take, and how were we going to think of the value of this protocol? And there's a great piece by I think it's on Grisha, if I'm not mistaken, same blog writer or whoever that did Proof of Work as a Decentralized Clock. I think that's what it is, but it's about technology holy wars or protocol holy wars, and talking about the early days of Linux and the internet and how this is like not new at all. And kind of why do these things turn into these holy wars? And one of the aspects brought up that I think is really key to this one is that once you start moving in a certain direction, or start allocating toward a certain like set of principles in the protocol, there's not really any going back. Like, those early days really do set for, you know, indefinitely out to the future, good or bad. You know, like, one could argue that, you know, Bitcoin has taken the bad route, but I think we're kind of vindicated over and over that is not the case. And I truly believe, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think that this is absolutely 100% the only thing that's meaningful about the value and the value case, like what is unique about Bitcoin in particular. And it is very, very reminiscent, this whole shift in which way to go in the protocol, this whole debate with the block size and how to push this thing going forward, whether to politicize changes in the protocol or whether we maintain consensus, which I think was really at the heart of it, that it's absolutely, absolutely akin to, and Jim Epstein really does a great job of laying out exactly why, but this is largely the same conversation that Saylin and Timothy May had in 1987. And, you know, like I said, if you listen to the show, you know I fall down on the Timothy May side of things. But I want to explain why. And it's that we have plenty of centralized systems. We have plenty of systems that grant control. And there's actually a piece, the thing that was linked to about, what was it? The Smart Contracts in the Third World, I think is titled. I can't remember. I don't have it right in front of me right now. But it's basically talking about the obfuscation of the property system and the corruption of it. And the high transaction costs and the inability to verify and all this stuff. And Saylin's argument really is that, and I think a lot of the people like talking about banking the unbanked and stuff, like kind of the, I guess you could say the big blocker or the Bcash side of things, really focus on transaction costs. And I think that is very uninteresting from a fundamental view. I think as a second and third layer problem, like secondary and tertiary to the ultimate problem, transaction costs come down when you solve the heart of the problem. I think those are further down the path of what the problem is. Like, for instance, like third world nations, and when you talk about like I read an extensive piece talking about property corruption on like real estate and stuff, like in Honduras and some areas, in really indicative, it's really kind of the norm in everything that you might consider the third world. The poorest places on the earth have incredibly unreliable property systems, or the ability to actually own something outside of you know, political corruption to actually sustain, and this is really This is the core of the problem. Understand, it's not for lack of technology or lack of abundance or the inability to produce enough food or enough housing that so much of the world is poor. And this is completely lost on a massive amount of people. That is not the problem. And it's certainly not that capitalism has kept them poor. Everyone was poor by default. And then free markets, which we don't have capitalism anymore. We have a gross blob of a corruption of what capitalism is supposed to mean. The absolutely simplest go back to principles argument you could be made is that free markets don't have bailouts. End of story. As soon as we entered that era, ignore all the stuff about central banking and the horrible disaster that that is, free markets just don't have bailouts. End of story. You don't get the political system doesn't get to choose who lives when everybody's acting responsibly and overleveraging themselves and who dies. But throw that aside. Poverty is the default, and free markets rise people out of poverty. And the core reason is property rights. What we consider the third world is largely, overwhelmingly, quote-unquote, the third world because they don't have any property rights. Because they don't have the ability to maintain and grow and sustain wealth outside of political corruption. It's just too easy to confiscate. And the article that I was talking about, that I referenced just a minute ago, was about the fact that property is literally stolen from people by just changing the records. They literally just go in and they're just like, scratch out somebody's name. Like politicians and stuff will bribe people, and officials, officers, everybody like within the government system is so corrupt that they literally bribe people by just giving them other people's property. They literally just erase names or reissue the property title with someone else, and then they go to court, and then suddenly this person is kicked off of their land. They're just taking everything from them because, oh, look, I have the record right here. I own this. But my good friend who gave to my political campaign, and here's my my good cousin who's in the records thing. Clearly, look at the record. It's got all the stamps of approval. It's got all everything here. This is clearly their property, not the person who's sitting on it right now. We got to boot them the hell out and give it to my buddy. And this is rampant. This is the consequence of a centralized system. This is why they cannot have a productive economy, because no one can maintain. No one can keep and grow the fruits of their labor. The system is so unbelievably corrupt and the confiscation is so widespread that it can't be sustained. The technology is there. Everything is there. The Industrial Revolution happened in the 1800s, people. It's not because they can't get access to stuff, or I guess in a sense that it's not like it doesn't exist. And it's certainly not because a whole country and a whole population doesn't stay poor because banks are charging them 10% fees instead of 2%. Like, that's just insult to injury. But the fundamental problem is a lack of property rights, a lack of ability to actually build a honest bank, an honest system to actually use that isn't immediately corrupted by the political jurisdictions that they're under. Building an extra political system of property rights is the only way to bring them out of poverty. There is nothing that you can do within the system that isn't just corrupted by default. And that's why I think Timothy May's direction or thought process is the only way that even comes close to working. Because when you're building within the system, when you're building within the construct of the current framing and authority, you're not going to be able to disrupt from within. You're not going to be able to join the mafia and then make the mafia peaceful. That's kind of what Salen is. It's, in a nutshell, that's a little bit of what Salen, maybe that's a little unfair, but from a principled standpoint, I feel like that is what Salen is arguing, is that we're going to work within the system and we're going to find these tiny little gray areas where they're not looking for a little bit, and then we're going to build something and they're not going to control it. Or they're not going to take advantage of it. And that's kind of at the heart of this, is the incumbents, the powers that be, the political jurisdiction, are always going to co-opt whatever technology exists or whatever technology is disrupting the old structures and trying to move us forward. That is always going to happen. So if you take Salen's soft approach of working under the assumption that co-option already exists and not trying to disrupt, you don't make any headway. But if you take May's approach, if you go for the most disruptive, most external technology and the most independent technology, it will actually grow and force the middle ground. It will force the gray area to exist. So that's going to happen either way. But the only way that we actually get the disruption is if we focus and build towards May's direction, in my mind. A good example here, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, the whole Simon Morris's Why BitTorrent Mattered series is great. I forgot the author off the top of my head. The piece on how decentralization dies. Absolutely love that piece. And it's talking about BitTorrent in particular and the rise and subsequently the fall of BitTorrent. But I think BitTorrent is an excellent example here. And in my mind, BitTorrent is the Timothy May route. Whereas, I guess maybe streaming and trying to disrupt the industry from the inside, you know, some centralized institution that tries to offer a new model, like the early music streaming and film and media streaming stuff on the internet is a great example here, because there were actually a number of pretty well-funded and beginning to really get established streaming services and I guess you could say reselling of music and movies and stuff online that would start to gain ground, but were shut down. And this was prior to the Netflix and Hulu days and prior to the Apple Music Store or iTunes, I guess, at the time. Apple was really the one with the amount of power to basically push through. But what was happening to a lot of these companies is that they were trying to lay the groundwork and get licensing, and they would fight for years with some of these companies, and none of them would let up on their copyright and licensing. None of them wanted to let this new technology come about. And while they were trying to work within the old paradigm, within the old incumbent power structures, they were never going to make any headway. They were never going to let any of the power, the pricing, the old model go away at all. It wasn't until BitTorrent and file sharing forced their hands. This was the very argument that Apple used. And BitTorrent, again, I'm considering the Timothy May route of doing it. Build something that's entirely external to them, that can't be shut down, that proves just how antiquated and at odds with the new technology the old system is. And it's like a form of protest. Okay, if you're not going to come to this new medium, if you're not going to take advantage of this new technology, we will, and we will leave you out of it. We will do it without your permission. And what that did is it was a form of protest that forced their hands to adopt the gray area. The only reason we got the Salen version of media today, of open streaming and really open licensing and the ability to quickly download and listen on any device, music and movies and all of this stuff, which was a nightmare for like a decade and a half. The only reason that happened is because Steve Jobs could go to those companies and say, you're going to lose it all anyway. Look at the downloads on file sharing. Look at the growth of BitTorrent. At the height of BitTorrent, it was 75% of all traffic on the internet. They knew they were losing the game because of the Timothy May Timothy May-esque technology that had landed in the world that they couldn't do anything about. They couldn't get the government to shut it down, no matter how much money they threw around, no matter how many moles they whacked to try to get it to go back into obscurity, it only made it stronger and it only made it bigger. That was why we got the streaming revolution. That was why we got the iTunes Store. They would have just kept shutting them down like they did the many, many precursors that attempted to come about until they knew they were going to lose regardless. And I think that's why it's the only path that makes sense from a political perspective, from a regulatory perspective. If we don't build something that's entirely outside of their purview, we'll never get the gray area. We'll never get any sort of direction in our way. The default incentive structure of the regulatory and political apparatus is to get more control, to get more bloated, and to grow. Therefore, if our focus is not to build systems entirely outside of it that cannot even be influenced by it, they'll never give up any ground. It will only ever get more corrupt, more controlling, and less free. It is the WikiLeaks of the world. It is the Tor networks of the world. It is the BitTorrent of the world. It is the Bitcoins of the world that force the incumbents and the current power structure to go to the people like Salen and say, okay, tell me about this again. Why is it that we should move to this gray area and actually accommodate some of this technology? Because otherwise they lose all of their power if they don't give up some of it. And that is the key to pushing us forward. That is why the Timothy May CypherNet BlackNet idea, I think, is the only route to push, because it's the only way we get the middle ground. If we build something that they can control out the gate, well, then we've not changed anything. We've done nothing useful. Just like Pierre Richard said, if I would not be interested in Bitcoin if governments didn't want to ban it. Beautiful. You couldn't explain it any better. We're not going to make any headway if it doesn't scare the crap out of the powers that be. Why would they ever let up any ground if they weren't afraid of it, if they weren't interested in stopping it? This piece really does a good job of kind of putting the whole thing in context. Epstein, I think, kind of just in the general, let me tell you about history, doesn't seem to, take any side in this. And I haven't watched the whole documentary series, so I don't know if that does attempt to say A is better than B, or if it's just kind of a objective telling of this is side A and this is side B, and look, this is what happened and this is where we are sort of thing. Like I said, I still have actually only watched the first part of the series, I really need to catch up. I'm embarrassed. There is a cyberpunk thing out there talking about the history of this stuff, and I have yet to fully watch it. I am sorry. I have failed. I will do better. But going back to the Amix thing, I love May's response. It's very like the response to the shitcoin esque like idea is that, oh yeah, I get Amix. It's a simple idea. Sure, it probably helps something maybe, but I don't see how it makes any significant impact. That's the response. Okay, get the idea. It's kind of neat, but as soon as you're some centralized thing that can easily be controlled, what massive change are you going to bring to the world? Quote, people aren't going to be selling meaningless stuff like surfboard recommendations. And what's funny is you actually kind of see that with the internet in general is even with the potential of microtransactions, you wonder if it's going to work, because like we're so much fighting for people's attention in this day and age, because we have so much information at our disposal. The value and the way to get someone's attention and to get them to be interested in what you're providing them is to give them good, solid information out the gate for free, so that they will come to you for more detailed, in-depth information. Like that's kind of the model for the internet, is provide stuff for free to get them to stick around and be interested and build a rapport and trust you, and give them extra content, or let them go further down the rabbit hole with you on whatever it is that you're digging into or you're trying to teach them about. But when it comes to money, when it comes to the core problems of money, it's not transaction costs. It just isn't. It is not because banks charge or credit cards charge 2% for every swipe that the Federal Reserve just printed $4 trillion out of thin air. Like the printing of $4 trillion is a societal problem. It is a massive, deep, fundamental political problem that creates a ruling class that does not have to provide for society, that can literally consume resources on net and destroy things and be completely propped up because they have a monetary advantage. They do not play by the same rules as the rest of the economy. They don't participate in the free market. We are stuck in the free market, and they siphon off all of the value we produce to destroy it and consume it however they wish. And any sort of pushback or regulation or cap or restriction on that is barely there. It is weak at best. And something like Libra is not going to challenge that at all. I mean, they explicitly say, oh, as soon as we're all totally within the controls and the regulations and everything of the current system that is causing massive systemic problems, then we'll be good to go. Or in other words, we have no interest in solving the massive systemic problems. Whereas Bitcoin is only focused on those massive systemic problems. And here's the thing. Again, back to the Timothy May Salem sort of argument, is that I only think we only really get the low-cost, frictionless, open and free-flowing world of money, global stage of monetary cooperation and a large cooperative market extranationally, that it is not any single jurisdiction. We only get Facebook's dream of frictionless payments for 1.7 billion people without banking access if we actually solve the underlying monetary problem. If we don't have a system of strong property rights, if we don't have an open and highly verifiable and permissionless system to operate from, then we're never going to get the future of frictionless open payments. I think the former is only derived from the latter. It is because of the regulatory controls. It is because of the awful inflation and the monopoly on counterfeiting that we cannot get those things. The technology is already there to make cheap payments. Why can't you? Because everything can be controlled. Because capital controls are everywhere. Because jurisdictions are put up in the digital space. Because everything that tries to get across them is centralized. It is only with the BitTorrent of money that they start to actually let those barriers down, because we break them by default and they have to let things through so that they can survive. If we don't push and focus 100% on total disruption, we won't get even partial disruption. And I think, you know, Saifedean and Jimmy Song, they really do a good job in the pieces that were suggested in this article, which again, like I said, are both in the podcast feed, The Truth About Smart Contracts by Jimmy Song, and, Saifedean's is not. Saifedean's is just the Bitcoin Standard, obviously. But if you haven't read that, then wow, you were behind on Bitcoin. That's like required reading, guys. Get on it. But Saifedean says in one of the quotes they did was that the nature of sound money lies precisely in the fact that no human is able to control it. It is outside of the need to trust. You can trust the money because we know we cannot trust the humans. Like, by nature, if you create some massive source of centralized power and the ability to corrupt, someone will use it for power and corruption. Period. So it is not sound money if someone can corrupt it. The solution isn't don't be evil, it's can't be evil systems. And Bitcoin exists, as he says, orthogonally to the law. It is simply outside. It is next to it and unrelated to it. There is virtually nothing that any government authority can do to affect or alter its operation. And Jimmy Song's great quote on this same basic idea is that if we have some token for some piece of property somewhere, and everybody knows, like, go back to the third world country's example where nobody has property rights and the whole system is corrupt. It's not like people don't know it's corrupt. It's not like people are like, oh my God, this is shocking news. They absolutely know it's corrupt. That's why everybody's constantly bribing officials. I mean, bribes are the way of things. They are a normal business cost just to operate in those countries. So it's not like they need transparency and everybody would be like, oh, well, dang, this, I can't believe we've let this go on. No, like, it's just that they know the government isn't going to recognize any of that because they have the power to just force everybody. So back to Jimmy Song's example, or his quote, is that if a judge refuses to honor the tokenized transaction, or a conqueror shows up at the door with an army, the smart contract will have accomplished nothing. Ownership of the token cannot have dependencies outside of the smart contracting platform, wrote Song, who sees smart contracts as useful only in systems like Bitcoin, where the digital token itself holds value. The blockchain cannot secure a piece of capital, a piece of value outside of the blockchain. It cannot protect your physical real estate. It cannot protect your car. It cannot protect your legal rights. It does none of those things. The only thing it can protect is something that is valuable within the system itself. Bitcoin. It is only because it settles Bitcoin and can perfectly verify all Bitcoin that we know the contract is worth something, that the contract will execute, and Bitcoin is the arbiter that says who owns what, end of story, nobody can contest it. And because people will be able to put value on a system that is orthogonal to all of these jurisdictions, to all of these political structures, because that thing exists, it will start to provide protection for things in the real world as political jurisdictions compete to appease the capital that moves into the system that can't be controlled. When they realize there is a world that does not need them at all, they will meet us halfway to actually make things better. But it only happens, in my opinion, if we build systems to replace them completely. That is why I am of the Tim May tradition here. But great piece, just great piece by Epstein here. Love that Reason is getting into all of this, and super excited about this series. I'll probably do another episode on this pretty soon just because it'll be fresh in my mind as I watch this. Maybe a guy's take or something like that. But for now, let's go ahead and close this episode out. Thank you guys so much for listening. Let me know what you think. Is it the Salen route? Is it the Timothy May route? How's your perspective on this? Hit me up on Twitter. Tag me. I'd love to argue, love to debate this stuff. And it's a fascinating topic. So I want to pose a question before we close this episode out, though. But let's go ahead and just thank our sponsor real quick, Hexel Wallet. You can find them at hexelwallet.io, and they are a mobile wallet. I mean, I'm sure you guys have been listening to the show, but they're a great mobile wallet with, really easy, like, able to make multiple accounts, and you can make them with different degrees of security. You have, like, your standard, like, single factor, single key, checking account, as it's referred to, and then you have a, multi-factor savings account. Then you can set up a donation account, which is the one I've noticed a number of you guys have gone to check it out. If you want to see the web front end, it's a really clever little thing they've done to, be able to accept donations easily and without having to just post an address somewhere. You can have a little web front end and the benefit of some privacy there. And you can check that out at guyswan.com/donate. That is my Hexel Wallet donation account that you're looking at there. And they've got another great feature that I harp on all the time because I just still think it's the coolest thing ever. And I can't believe that all mobile wallets haven't done this, is built-in batching. You can just add contacts and, you know, scan different addresses and everything during a transaction. And you can just add a new contact and scan a new address and just keep adding amounts to each one so that you save a huge amount on fees. You just batch your own transactions to multiple different places at the same time. And that's just such a cool feature. And I really hope it becomes a standard and that Hexa pushes everyone else in the mobile wallet industry, so to speak, to adopt that. Really cool stuff going on over there. Much love to those guys for supporting Bitcoin Audible. Check them out again, Hexa Wallet on the Google Play and Apple App Store, or hexawallet.io. So the question I want to pose is, using BitTorrent as kind of our analogy for, you know, the hand that we're trying to force in the financial system to get rid of capital controls, to lower the barriers and make it like able to make anyone able to, the unbanked, you know, the 1.7 billion unbanked, able to send transactions as cheaply and freely as an image or as a text message across any and all borders. How do you do that when, like, that's already possible? Is it not? Like, technologically, we've already solved that problem. PayPal and Venmo have solved that problem. But they're not able to work in those countries. And it's not because the technology doesn't allow them to send messages across into the jurisdiction. It's that they're not legally allowed to operate. The jurisdiction itself, the political system, doesn't allow them to operate within the country. And the capital controls and the financial restrictions and the desire, the incredible need for those systems to control and to limit their population from access and use of other currencies makes that completely at odds with them. So in the analogy with BitTorrent, how long without BitTorrent to force their hand, to show them how antiquated the media and copyright and the licensing was, to show them that they didn't have a choice? If we never had that technology and we were just waiting for them to alter their licensing so that streaming services, so that iTunes could exist, and that they would have to cut, you know, all the fat and open themselves up to this massive amount of competition in this entirely new industry, how long would we have to wait? How long before we actually got that future? How long before they voluntarily just said, okay, if Steve Jobs had to go into that recording, that the copyright office, without any leverage whatsoever, to say that, oh, well, you can keep your current licensing model and your current industry structure in this new age, but you should do this because this is better, would they have done it? How long would it have taken? And if we take the same analogy to the financial system, to government control, to the monopoly of the currency within certain jurisdictions, how long have we waited for them to let PayPal cross borders without costs? How long? Why isn't this problem already solved? It's not a technology problem. It is not a technology problem. It's a control problem. And that is what Bitcoin solves. Without an independent, solid foundation that is free from their control, that is indifferent to their capital controls, to their sanctions, that is as impossible to shut down as BitTorrent, and as impossible to ignore as the internet, why would they ever change? That's why, personally, I'm with Timothy May. If we have to ask permission for our freedom, well, then we aren't going to get it. I say we build something unstoppable and take it. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.